Parables of Nature by Margaret Gatti. Read by Tim Lario. 5. Training and Restraining. Train up a child in the way he should go. Proverbs 22, verse 6. "What a fuss is made about you, my dear little friends," murmured the wind one day to the flowers in a pretty villa garden. "I am really quite surprised at your submitting so patiently and meekly to all the troublesome things that are done to you. I have been watching your friend the gardener for some time today, and now that he is gone at last, I am quite curious to hear what you think and feel about your unnatural bringing up."
"Is it unnatural?" inquired a beautiful convolvulus major from the top of a tapering fir pole up which she had crept and from which her velvet flowers hung suspended like purple gems.
"I smile at your question," was the answer of the wind. "You surely cannot suppose that in a natural state you would be forced to climb regularly up one tall bare stick such as I see you upon now. Oh, dear, no. Your cousin, the wild convolvulus, whom I left in the fields this morning, does no such thing, I assure you. She runs along and climbs about just as the whim takes her. Sometimes she takes a turn upon the ground. Sometimes she enters a hedge and plays at bow-peep with the birds in the thorn and the nut-trees, twisting here, curling there, and at last, perhaps, coming out at the top and overhanging the hedge with a canopy of green leaves and pretty white flowers. A very different sort of life from yours, with a gardener always after you, trimming you in one place, fastening up a stray tendril in another, and fidgeting you all along, a sort of perpetual, 'Mustn't go here, mustn't go there.' Poor thing! I quite feel for you. Still, I must say, you make me smile, for you look so proud and self-conscious of beauty all the time that one would think you did not know in what a ridiculous and dependent position you are placed." Now, the convolvulus was quite abashed by the words of the wind, for she was conscious of feeling very conceited that morning, in consequence of having heard the gardener say something very flattering about her beauty. So she hung down her rich bell-flowers rather lower than usual and made no reply. But the carnation put in her word,
"What you say about the convolvulus may be true enough, but it cannot apply to me. I am not aware that I have any poor relations in this country, and I myself certainly require all the care that is bestowed upon me. This climate is both too cold and too damp for me. My young plants require heat, or they would not live, and the pots we are kept in protect us from those cruel wire-worms who delight to destroy our roots."
"Oh," cried the wind, "our friend the carnation is quite profound and learned in her remarks, and I admit the justice of all she says about damp and cold and wire-worms, but—" And here the wind gave a low-toned whistle as he took a turn round the flower-bed. "But what I maintain, my dear, is that when you are once strong enough and old enough to be placed in the soil, those gardeners ought to let you grow and flourish as nature prompts, and as you would do were you left alone. But no, forsooth, they must always be clipping and trimming and twisting up every leaf that strays aside out of the trim pattern they have chosen for you to grow in. Why not allow your silver tufts to luxuriate in a natural manner? Why must every single flower be tied up by its delicate neck to a stick the moment it begins to open? Really, with your natural grace and beauty, I think you might be trusted to yourself a little more." And the carnation began to think so too, and her color turned deeper as a feeling of indignation arose within her at the childish treatment to which she had been subjected.
"With my natural grace and beauty," repeated she to herself, "they might certainly trust me to myself a little more."
Still, the rose tree stood out that there must be some great advantages in a gardener's care, for she could not pretend to be ignorant of her own superiority to all her wild relations in the woods. What a difference in size and color and in fragrance! Then the wind assured the rose that he never meant to dispute the advantage of her living in a rich-soiled garden, only there was a natural way of growing even in a garden, and he thought it a great shame for the gardeners to force the rose-tree into an unnatural way, curtailing all the energies of her nature. What could be more outrageous, for example, than to see one rose growing in the shape of a bush on top of the stem of another? "Think of all the pruning necessary," cried he, "to keep the poor thing in the round shape so much admired. And what is the matter with the beautiful straggling branches, that they are to be cut off as fast as they appear? Why not allow the healthy rose-tree its free and glorious growth? Why thwart its graceful droopings or its high aspirings?
Can it be too large or too luxuriant? Can its flowers be too numerous? Oh, Rose Tree, you know your own surpassing merits too well to make you think this possible.
And so she did, and a new light seemed to dawn upon her as she recollected the spring and autumnal prunings she regularly underwent, and the quantities of little branches that were yearly cut from her sides and carried away in a wheelbarrow.
"It is a cruel and monstrous system, I fear," said she.
Then the wind took another frolic round the garden, and made up to the large white lily, into whose refined ear he whispered a doubt as to the necessity or advantage of her thick, powerful stem being propped up against a stupid, ugly stick.
He really grieved to see it. Did that lovely creature suppose that nature, who had done so much for her that the fame of her beauty extended throughout the world, had yet left her so weak and feeble that she could not support herself in the position most calculated to give her ease and pleasure?
"Always this tying up and restraint," pursued the wind with an angry puff. "Perhaps I am prejudiced, but as to be deprived of freedom would be to me an absolute death, so my soul revolts from every shape and phase of slavery."
"Not more than mine does,"
cried the proud white lily, leaning as heavily as she could against the strip of matting that tied her to the stick. But it was of no use. She could not get free, and the wind only shook his sides and laughed spitefully as he left her, and then rambled away to talk the same shallow philosophy to the honeysuckle that was trained up against a wall. Indeed, not a flower escaped his mischievous suggestions. He murmured among them all, laughed the trim-cut box-hedges to scorn, maliciously hoped the sweet peas enjoyed growing in a circle and running up a quantity of crooked sticks, and told the flowers, generally, that he should report their unheard-of submission and meek obedience wherever he went. Then the white lily called out to him in great wrath, and told him he mistook their characters altogether. They only submitted to these degrading restraints because they could not help themselves, but if he would lend them his powerful aid, they might free themselves from at least a part of the unnatural bonds which enthralled them. To which the wicked wind, seeing that his temptations had succeeded, replied in great glee that he would do his best, and so he went away, chuckling at the discontent he had caused. All that night the pretty, silly flowers bewailed their slavish condition and longed for release and freedom, and at last they began to be afraid that the wind had only been jesting with them, and that he would never come to help them as he had promised. However, they were mistaken, for at the edge of the dawn there began to be a sighing and a moaning in the distant woods, and by the time the sun was up, the clouds were driving fast along the sky, and the trees were bending about in all directions, for the wind had returned. Only now he had come in his roughest and wildest mood, knocking over everything before him.
"Now is your time, pretty flowers!" shouted he, as he approached the garden. And "Now is our time!" echoed the flowers tremulously, as with a sort of fearful pleasure they awaited his approach.
He managed the affair very cleverly, it must be confessed. Making a sort of eddying circuit round the garden, he knocked over the convolvulus pole, tore the strips of base from the stick that held up the white lily, loosed all the carnation flowers from their fastenings, broke the rose tree down, and leveled the sweet peas to the ground. In short, in 1/2 hour he desolated the pretty garden, and when his work was accomplished he flew off to rave about his deed of destruction in other countries. Meanwhile, how had it fared with the flowers? The wind was scarcely gone before a sudden and heavy rain followed, so that all was confusion for some time. But towards the evening the weather cleared up, and our friends began to look round them. The white lily still stood somewhat upright, though no friendly pole supported her juicy stem, but, alas, it was only by a painful effort she could hold herself in that position. The wind and the weight of rain had bent her forward once beyond her strength, and there was a slight crack in one part of the stalk, which told that she must soon double over and trail upon the ground. The convolvulus fared still worse. The garden bed sloped towards the south, and when our friend was laid on the earth, her pole having fallen, her lovely flowers were choked up by the wet soil which drained towards her. She felt the muddy weight as it soaked into her beautiful velvet bells, and could have cried for grief. She could never free herself from this nuisance. Oh, that she were once more climbing up the friendly fir pole! The honeysuckle escaped no better, and the carnation was ready to die of vexation at finding that her coveted freedom had leveled her to the dirt. Before the day closed, The gardener came whistling from his farm work to look over his pretty charges. He expected to see a few drooping flowers, and to find that one or two fastenings had given way. But for the sight that awaited him, he was not prepared at all. Struck dumb with astonishment, he never spoke at first, but kept lifting up the heads of the trailing, dirtied flowers in succession. Then, at last, he broke out into words of absolute sorrow.
"And to think of my mistress and the young lady coming home so soon, and that nothing can be done to these poor things for a fortnight because of the corn harvest. It's all over with them, I fear."
And the gardener went his way. Alas, what he said was true, and before many days had passed, the shattered carnations were rotted with lying in the wet and dirt on the ground. The white lily was languishing discolored on its broken stalk. The convolvulus flowers could no longer be recognized, they were so coated over with mud stains. The honeysuckle was trailing along among battered sweet peas, who never could succeed in shaking the soil from their fragrant heads. And though the rose tree had sent out a few straggling branches, she soon discovered that they were far too weak to bear flowers, nay, almost to support themselves, so that they added neither to her beauty nor her comfort. Weeds, meanwhile, sprang up, and a dreary confusion reigned in the once orderly and brilliant little garden. At length, one day before the fortnight was over, the house-dog was heard to bark his noisy welcome, and servants bustled to and fro. The mistress had returned, and the young lady was with her, and hurried at once to her favorite garden. She came bounding towards the well-known spot with a song of joyous delight. But on reaching it, suddenly stopped short, and in a minute after burst into a flood of tears. Presently, with sorrowing steps, she bent her way round the flower-beds, weeping afresh at every one she looked at, and then she sat down upon the lawn, and hid her face in her hands. In this position she remained until a gentle hand was laid upon her shoulder.
"This is a sad spectacle indeed, my darling," said her mother's voice.
"Never mind about the garden, mamma," replied the young girl, lifting up her tearful face. "We can plant new flowers, and tie up even some of these afresh. But what I have been thinking is that now, at last, I quite understand what you have often said about the necessity of training, and restraint, and culture, for us as well as for flowers, in a fallen world. The wind has torn away these poor things from their fastenings, and they are growing wild whichever way they please. I know I should once have argued that if it were their natural mode of growing, it must therefore be the best. But I cannot say so, now that I see the result. They are doing whatever they like, unrestrained, and the end is that my beautiful garden is turned into a wilderness."